Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Back in February, during the Republican presidential primary debate in Houston, Florida Senator Marco Rubio and businessman Donald Trump argued over something to do with the Affordable Care Act.
What is your plan? I understand the lines around the state, whatever that means. This is not a game where you draw maps
and you
around.
You don't know what it is.
What is your plan?
That's the problem.
You what is your plan on health care? You don't
biggest
have a
problem.
Plan.
The biggest problem
is,
he doesn't
I'll give
know.
You one minute
the biggest problem
tell me his
he's
plan.
Got is he
What's
doesn't
plan?
Know. You know, I watched him melt down 2 weeks ago with Chris Christie. I got to tell you, the biggest problem he's got is he really doesn't know about the lines.
The crowd loved the conflict, it seemed, but anyone looking for some substance there would have been disappointed. Politics rarely is pretty these days, but the incivility that has emerged in this national election cycle could be unparalleled. Today, we're talking about what civility means, the impact of incivility, and how to achieve the right balance of conflict and conversation. Next week, former State Representative Ted Celeste will moderate a panel discussion at the Mershon Center for International Security Studies at Ohio State University to consider ways in which all political parties, regardless of ideology, can build compromise, work together, and listen to each other's ideas. Ted Celeste, he's director of state programs and leads Next Generation. That's a project of the National Institute on Civil Discourse. He joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann. Excited to be here.
Also joining us is OSU political scientist and chair of peace studies at OSU, Christopher Gelpe. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me as well.
First, some definitions. Do we even know what we mean by civility, and does it mean the same thing at all times? Ted Celeste?
You know, the best definition I've heard is to disagree without being disagreeable, that it is there's an opportunity to maintain your strong positions and ideals, but you can have respect for the other person's position while you have your discourse.
I went back to some old debates, you know, through the years, and have to say that they did appear, contrasting them to the current cycle, they were almost boring. It was sad to hear that. And yet I can see the appeal. It's understandable, the appeal of that arguing like we've heard.
You know, one of the things that as I listened to that promo you did that's disappointing is that the debates have become entertainment and not real discussions of the issues, unfortunately. And by having audience participation and encouraging it, it raises the level of disrespect, et cetera. And so it creates problems. Hopefully the debates in the fall by the presidential commission will be different and you won't have that same kind of participation.
And I think it really is sort of rooted in what moves voters and what politicians feel they need to do to move voters. And one of the things that will move voters is fear. And so we see this sort of level of polarization and disrespect generating fear about the other side. So one of the things that leads to this kind of disrespect, I think, is you see the increasing proportion of Americans who describe the other party as a threat to America. And that's just something that, you know, in the debates you were talking about before, nobody thought that either side was a threat to America.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about civility in politics. My guest, you just heard from Christopher Gelpe. He's political scientist and chair of peace studies at Ohio State University. Also with us, former state representative Ted Celeste. He's the director of state programs at the National Institute on Civil Discourse, and he'll be moderating a panel discussion on civility.
Very civil discussion.
Civil discussion on civility in politics next week. Check the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides for more on that. And what do we mean by listening? What does that even mean nowadays, Christopher Gelpe?
Well, I think that, you know, in order to listen, you have to be willing to hear what the other side has to say without immediately arming yourself with a sort of a rebuttal that we see often people so ready to counter argue that they're putting forward a counter argument before they even hear what the other side has to say, much less try to listen to what's the motivation or what's the feeling behind what's being said.
I'd add one thing, that the interesting dynamic lately has been that we all tend to silo now to those with the same opinion. And so there's less and less opportunities to listen to the other side. And one of the things that we're doing through the National Institute is encouraging people to reach out. We actually have a brief video that we show in a lot of our programs called Unlikely Friendships, which really states the problem that you don't get two sides together in a setting where they really want to listen to each other. And I think that's an important part of listening.
I just want to underline the importance of that. I really agree with that point, because I think what we need to understand is that this is rooted in some really sort of fundamental changes in American society, and the institutions that used to pull us together that are coming apart with changes in technology, whether it's changes in how people get their news, mm-hmm. or changes in distributions of where people live. So people are moving to neighborhoods where everybody is like them, or people are getting their news on Facebook where they filter it through their friends who are all like them. But all these institutions that used to bring people who didn't agree with each other together, they're falling away due to technological changes. And so the kind of work that Mr. Celeste is doing, I think, is really important to sort of try to rebuild those institutions.
And I just, yeah, just one other thing that made me click to my mind, that listening, unfortunately, is not responding to some of the tirades and encouragement of hostility that's going on in political discourse now. And unfortunately, what's happened is that's led to a new level of incivility, if you will, with actual violence. And it's really that that activity which has inspired the Institute to create a national campaign called Revive Civility, Our Democracy Depends on It, that everyone is responsible. Citizens, elected officials, the media, we're all responsible for changing that dynamic.
You know, there was incivility. There was violence in 1968, too. I mean, it's not like it was invented this year. So what's the difference between then and now? Ted Celeste?
Well, a couple of things. I would say that we've not had candidates who've used the language of encouragement of violence. There were strong feelings. There were a lot of folks who were in the streets because they felt strongly about their ideals, but that not necessarily there at the encouragement of candidates. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, one of the big differences.
Well, I do think there are some similarities between now and 1968. I don't want to overplay it, because I don't think we're going to see the level of violence probably that we saw then. I certainly hope we don't.
Particularly on the part of the police.
Right.
Yeah.
But I do think that there's some similarities in terms of alienation of segments of the voting public, that the source of this, both in 68 and now, is a segment of the American public who no longer believes that the political system can work for them. And so there's no point in listening and debating and compromising if you don't think that the system can work for you. And so, I mean, that's why I think either the talking on the sort of the side of the Trump supporters who just think that that the whole system is rigged, or on the left with the Sanders supporters, when they start to talk about the system being rigged, that's when you get into these sort of dangerous areas for civility, because they no longer believe in the process.
You know, it seems to me, Ted Celeste, that you run the risk of preaching to the choir next week at that panel discussion. I have a feeling that the folks hooting and hollering at those GOP presidential primary candidates or any of the debates back through the fall and the winter aren't interested in listening. And I'm wondering how you get buy-in to something like this beyond the people that are already coming because they believe in what you're saying.
It's a very good point. And, you know, a part of you mentioned that I'm a director of Next Generation, which we have a workshop that trains legislators around the country in this process of civil discourse. And when we first started, we were finding that we were preaching to the choir, the people who believed in it. But as more and more leadership got involved, as more folks got involved and experienced this discussion, We're finding that there's receptivity. So hopefully, just and particularly now in 2016, because of the level of the intensity of this discussion, you're going to have more and more people be involved who do need to hear it. And I think that, again, it's important for people to be part of this is people to be reaching out to those others and to bring them along. Bring a friend who might you might disagree with. Bring a friend on Monday night. That will make a difference.
And I think one of the places where it's important to reach out, which Mr. Celeste is doing, which is in institutions that everybody needs to be in, that they're sort of forced to be in, that brings in people from both sides. So, for example, the legislature, right? If you were, they're going to be Democrats and Republicans in there, and so if you can get connected to those institutions that we still do have that bring together people who disagree, that's the place where the greatest kind of work can do. So on Monday night, there we will have a Democratic and Republican legislators there trying to talk to each other. So those are the kinds of places where I think maybe you can get the buy-in.
Voter participation has been good this cycle in the primaries. And so when you're talking about alienation, I'm wondering where the disconnect is with that. If people feel alienated and yet they're voting more than they have in the past in primaries, what's it mean then?
Well, I mean, my response would be the interesting dynamic has been the level of interest on both sides of someone outside the normal political process. So you have Bernie on the left, you have Trump on the other side, where that sense of alienation gets expressed. And we want to have something different. And I think that's where a lot of the participation, increased participation is coming from.
A lot of energy is going just to unify the parties within themselves, let alone unify the country. And they're not very successful at least on the Republican side yet. The Democratic side, we'll see. I mean, Bernie Sanders says he's still going to go to the end. How are they talking to each other? What do we learn from what's going on at the party level with this disunity?
Well, it's really been a remarkable cycle in that way that challenges a lot of what has been some of the conventional wisdom in political science research,
right,
anyway, about how candidates get selected. And I think, you know, it's sort of shown some of, again, well, again, I keep going back to this, but I think it shows some of the consequences of the erosion of institutions. So party institutions have slowly been sort of eroded by, I think, some of the rhetoric that the parties have chosen to use in order to motivate their following. They actually undermine the legitimacy of the institution itself. So part of the appeal of the Republican Party for some time now has been to sort of challenge the legitimacy of government. And they've fueled a lot of energy from their voters that way, but they've actually undermined the legitimacy of their own party establishment by doing it.
And because now, it's so part of the government.
It's part of the government. And so that becomes part of the problem. And so they've sort of undermined the legitimacy of their own institution.
Now, Ted Celeste, I know you're a Democrat. You know, that's where you sit. But when you look at what's happened to the Republican Party, it could happen in the Democratic Party too or not.
Well, I think it could. I mean, I think part of the issue is whether the two sides that are still at it with Bernie and Secretary Clinton can come together, and that they do it in a way that the supporters of both feel good about it. I mean, I remember back in my first presidential campaign when I was running around the country for George McGovern, and I was passionate, and I, you know, nobody could tell me differently, including my brother, who was for somebody else initially. And so I can totally understand the strong feelings that people have about the process and about the parties. You know, one of the things, unfortunate things that's happened with the parties is the emphasis on winning. I mean, this is true for me in the legislature. It got in the way, I thought.
No matter what.
I thought it got in the way often of really having good discussion about good public policy.
We are talking about civility in politics. It's not an oxymoron, I don't think, or civil politics. If you have a question or comment, what do you think? Let's talk about solutions now and not personalities. How do you think we can go about changing the tenor of political discourse in the United States these days? Give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can check out our Facebook page, or you can tweet us at WOSU. All Sides. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about civility in politics, what it looks like, what it sounds like, why it matters, and how to achieve it. Still with us is former State Representative Ted Celeste. He's Director of State Programs and leads Next Generation. That's a project of the National Institute on Civil Discourse. Next week, he'll moderate a panel discussion at the Mershon Center for International Security Studies at OSU to consider how political parties can build compromise and listen to each other's ideas. Also with us, political scientist and chair of peace studies at OSU, Christopher Gelpe. And joining us now by phone is Scott Aiken. He is a professor of philosophy at Vanderbilt University and co-author of the 2014 book, Why We Argue and How We Should, A Guide to Political Disagreement. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Scott Aiken, you say there's a way to disagree about politics. Is this a lost art, or have we never really necessarily gotten there yet?
Well, people seem to naturally argue. We disagree. We think that reasons are on our side, so we do our best to share them. The great irony is that even though we think that reason is on our side, and we even try to display those reasons and argument and so on, we seem to never take each other very seriously, take the other side very seriously. One of the big lessons that I think that we should take from whenever we've changed our mind, we look back on whenever we've changed our mind about something important, we found out that there were important things that we were overlooking in the past. And so we need to be able to turn that eye towards the future and towards the people around us. John Stuart Mill had a very famous view about this, that you don't know your own view until you know the objections and the reasons against it. And if you think that you can answer them, that's how to do it. And so in some ways, it's an attitude towards your own views that we have to change, and that we have to, and that, in fact, really what grown-ups have learned. But you look back on your life and you see that you've changed your mind because of reasons.
You know, we were talking earlier about the need to win, that winning's everything now. Political parties will whatever it takes to get a win, whether it's gerrymandering or whatever they have to do. Everybody has to be a winner, it seems like, too. There's this also that other thread running through our society where everybody gets an award for just showing up. It makes me wonder to what extent that's affected our discourse, that need to win.
Well, because democracies have votes, and we often just get either people in place or we vote on a policy. And generally, you put policies forward that you think are right. You hope that they win. So in some ways, it might be something that's endemic to the way that we run our politics. But given the fact that we can always go back and reconsider, given the fact that we don't just put things forward and vote on them, we have discussions, we can revise them. I think that having that attitude of being able to say, look, I'm going to propose something that I think is about right, but I'm willing to hear the reasons against it and revise if those reasons are good.
Right. That's the art of compromise, right?
So maybe a point here about the difference between being able to revise and being able to compromise.
Okay.
So compromise, in some ways, is finding a kind of a middle ground. But you might say sometimes there are no reasons for you to change your view. If mm-hmm. you might say, we want to hear the reasons against it, but if there are no good reasons, we don't need to compromise with no good reasons. Finding middle grounds with folks that have no reasons on their side. We don't compromise with flat earth theorists. We don't compromise with the Nazis. So again, those are extreme cases, but in some ways, what we want to have is, you might say, openness to evidence. And so the art of compromise in some ways is a kind of a trying to find middle ground, whereas I think that this view that I'm trying to get out is one that's more about, look, I want to hear what the best reasons are, and if the best reasons are just on my side, then that's just the way that's going to have to be, and I've got to be able to convince the folks on the other side that that's the case.
Yeah, Ted Celeste.
Hi, Scott. Thanks for joining. Good to have you on the show as well. You know, I was just listening while you were speaking to and hearing the discussions last night and the day before of commentators about what's going on with the comments that Trump made that some are calling racist, and some have actually then said we're unendorsing a candidate, and it's forcing this issue of winning at anything. Are you willing to understand that if you hold racism as something that you won't allow to happen, can you then support someone who is, you are saying, is identified that way? And it gets to the point of, where do you draw the line with your support for parties?
Right, Ted. So I think that one of the things that – so there's a great irony to a lot of these unendorsements is that we have a long history in Democratic politics, and even, say, for example, with John Kerry changing his mind about things. Hmm. They called them flip-floppers in the past. And maybe that's even going to be a case that's going to be the case going forward. But in this case, where people have unendorsed Trump, they're not flip-flopping. They've got new evidence about this guy. He said something now that is indefensible, and now they say, "Look, this is not going to be something that we can go forward with." So I agree with you, Ted. I think that there are some things that that we say, "Look, there's just not going to be good reasons for this, and we're not going to be able to move. We're not going to compromise on this."
Chris in Galena, you're on the air. Hi, Chris.
Hi, great topic. And I'm curious, when somebody changes their mind and the press or the media or our whole culture decides that it's called flip-flopping and that's a vilified, horrible thing to do, how do we change our perception of it's okay to change your mind and it's okay when it's a logical, when you've got reasoning for it? How do we do that?
That's a really interesting question, Chris. The first time I encountered that whole issue when I was a State House reporter covering the governor's race, and Tony Celebrezze, the Democratic candidate back then, flip-flopped on 920, which was the law that established how property taxes were calculated in the state of Ohio. And he said, "I think we could revisit it." And it was in a debate. And the place just exploded inside the press room. And I'm like, well, what's wrong with saying revisit? And here I was a reporter. So how has it gotten to that? Christopher Jelpy, what are we talking about there? Can't we change our minds?
Yes. I mean, being able to change our minds has to be an important part of governing. I think it's interesting that there's some political science research on this sort of flip-flopping issue, and it really seems to show actually that flip-flopping hurts candidates less than we think. Hmm. We have this belief, because it gets repeated all the time, that changing your position really hurts, but it turns out actually voters pay more attention to what your new policy position is than they do whether you changed your mind. So sure, they like somebody who's always agreed with them better than somebody who just started to agree with them. But they like somebody who just started to agree with them better than they like somebody who still disagrees with them. So yeah. So I think there's this fear among politicians about being called a flip-flopper because of a few cases of people like John Kerry really getting beaten up for it. But actually, it doesn't hurt politicians as much as we think.
But, hey, yeah, Ted Celeste.
Chris and Galena. as opposed to my partner here in the studio. I think the question you raised goes right to the point that Scott was making about new information. As people get new information, they tend to revise what they think about things. And what I can think of in my lifetime and in the issues that have been discussed when I was a legislator on the LGBT issues, if you think about how that moved over time, as people got more and more information, their opinions changed. And so now we have, you know, same-sex marriage. And so it's a very important aspect that Scott raised about new information.
Scott Egan?
Yeah, I think we have a lot of people saying that they've evolved on that issue. And sometimes that means – and I think the reason why we even worry about the change of view is that you might say – and this is a worry that sometimes sticks to the Clintons – is that – they're just blowing in the wind, that they're just saying whatever is going to get them elected or say whatever is going to get them the plaudits. And that's the worry, which is, and that's a worry about democracies anyhow, the worry that you're just going to speak to the crowd and whatever the crowd thinks is, and whatever you're going to be able to get the most out of them. And so the worry that's there is that we have somebody who's just not principled, someone who's not going to, and someone who's not very sincere. I'm glad to hear that Chris has given us some information that flip-flopping charges don't hurt candidates quite as much. But it certainly seems to once you see a sort of a history of people flip-flopping, or you might say as the Clinton things that happen with the Clintons, they triangulate. There's a worry about them being sincere. There's a worry about them not, you might say, following the evidence, but now just, you might say, following the crowd.
Chris, thanks for that call. If anyone else has a question or a comment, wants to join the conversation, 614-292-8513. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Have we changed? Is something like the whole flip-flopping issue something that's changed over time? For one thing, I mean, someone like a John Kerry was in office for a long time. A lot of people, I'm not sure it's going to come up as much when we have term limits and we have turnover like we have had in Congress in the last 10 years, I would say. You're not going to have that history of that. But when it comes to endorsements and that sort of thing, a lot of people are questioning the authenticity of that. And they're questioning, well, what if Bernie does, you know, he'll drop out of the race and then he'll say he's for Hillary. Well, how does that wash with people that have been following him and supporting him because he's against Hillary? They worry about authenticity. Can I believe him? Scott Aiken?
So I think that, and by the way, this goes to the heart of, you might say, the passion issue that both Ted and Chris were talking about earlier, which is that, look, you want, you half of the reason why you're having these conversations in politics are because of the fact that you believe that something's right. And when you see somebody come around, and especially if they're, you might say, they've got a kind of iconic status as being somebody who embodies those ideals, and then when you see them come around and endorse somebody that they'd been standing against for a long time, there's a great deal of disappointment that goes along with this. And I think that one of the reasons why civility should be at the forefront of our minds is that, on the one hand, there's a lot of passion there, and there's a lot of emotion tied up with it. But I think that also the civility norms alienate people. I mean, they're not just alienated by the system. They're alienated by the fact that they don't feel like they're being heard. And whenever the civility norms are put in place, they feel like they've got a sort of a different kind of silencing. They feel like, look, I'm not being heard. I'm not doing so well in the system. And whenever I'm trying to express my frustration with this, I'm being told that I've been uncivil. And so there's a kind of double bind. With the civility norms. On the one hand, they're for productive discussion, but I think that especially from the people who feel particularly alienated by the system, civility norms are just another imposition of their outsider status and their alienation.
Because it's uncivil because of what they're saying and not
That's right.
how they're saying it.
How they're saying it, right. If they're alienated, they're not going to be speaking. They're a lot of the ways that they're going to be presenting their challenges and a lot of the ways that they're going to even be confrontational about the issues. Because, look, I mean, a lot of argument, a lot of politics is a kind of an adversarial model. It escalates very quickly, especially if people feel like they haven't been treated fairly.
You know, I grew up with the idea that when you go to a cocktail party, the euphemism for anything social, I suppose, is we're not supposed to talk about religion or politics, right? So that said, whatever your euphemism is for a cocktail party these days, Christopher Gelby, how do we practice this? When are we going to talk about it? Where do we learn about this in everyday life?
Well, I do think it's getting increasingly difficult to find places where we run into people who disagree with us. And I think we actually need to try to start seeking that out or at least not deliberately avoiding it. So, you know, don't unfriend your friends on Facebook from a different political party, right? Let yourself still see their posts and try to respond to them in a civil manner, which you know, try to cultivate those places where we do run into people who disagree with us, and be aware that if you don't approach somebody in a civil manner, you're just going to further cut off the conversation.
Yeah, I guess Ted Celeste, for a lot of people, Facebook or Twitter is where it's at right now.
Yeah, and unfortunately, it's pretty easy to use those vehicles to spew venom and not feel the consequences. You can't read body language. You can't see the intensity of the response. You often don't really think about the power of the words that you're using. It's so easy to do it. So while it's been a blessing in opening up communication capabilities for so many more people to see and hear, it's also provided people this anonymity to make these comments, which can be really troublesome.
Yeah. Scott Eakin, where do you practice these principles?
Well, I liked what Chris had said, which is with social media, keeping the lines of communication open with those whom you disagree with. I think that that's right. And Ted had also suggested the thought that debate is entertainment, and this never taking the bait with, you might say, the antagonism is part of it. I think also one of the ways that you can practice these arts of civility is doing your best to read the best of the other side. So Facebook may not be the best place to be able to get the best argument from the other side. Generally, the posts are pretty short, or they'll link to something. So I consider myself a pretty middle-of-the-road person, but I read my news feeds are from as far left and as far right as I can go. And I do my best to sort of read up and read the best versions of the arguments from the other side. And it's hard to maintain that because so many of, say, for example, the way that our news feeds get fed to us is that we get the siloing effect as Ted had identified it as, that we just seem to get the news from, and we get the versions of the views of the other side from our side. The best way to get the version of the view from the other side is from the other side and from the best people on the other side. And so make sure that your news feed is not one that's just from the MSNBC and side or the Fox News side. Make sure that it's as broad as it can be, and it's not going to be just infotainment on one side or the other, because then you'll actually be able to understand why they're saying what they're saying and the reasons that they've got.
We are talking about civility in politics, how to disagree agreeably, I suppose, how to agree to disagree nicely. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. We're talking about civility in politics, what it looks like, why it matters, and how to achieve it. Researchers at MIT's Media Lab are actually studying how our toxic political and public discourse how toxic it has become on Twitter, and it's not good. Still with us is former State Representative Ted Celeste. He's Director of State Programs and leads Next Generation, a project of the National Institute on Civil Discourse. Next week, he's moderating a panel discussion at the Mershon Center for International Security Studies at OSU to consider how political parties can build compromise and listen to each other's idea. And you can learn more about that at the link at our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Also, political scientist and chair of peace studies at OSU, Christopher Gelpe, and by phone, Scott Aiken, professor of philosophy at Vanderbilt University and co-author of the 2014 book, Why We Argue and How We Should, A Guide to Political Disagreement. Questions or comments? Join the conversation, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So much of what Americans disagree about centers on some very specific values now. I feel like we're sort of getting down to the brass tacks when it comes to the issues that we are debating in the United States, social issues such as immigration, abortion rights, LGBT rights, all of that kind of thing. Is that just my imagination, Christopher Gelpe, or is it the same old things we've been arguing about all along?
No, I do think that that's a major cleavage in politics, and I think it's a way in which parties are able to move well, in particular, I'd argue the Republican Party has been able to move the conversation away from economic divides to find other divides where they can put together a coalition around these sorts of values. And so that's why you see us see so many fights about LGBT rights and so on, like you're saying, because by debating these things, they can shift the debate away from issues where they might not be in the majority.
Hmm. Ted Celeste, I mean, is what we're talking about, arguing about these days, different in your mind or not so much? I don't know.
I think that the strong feelings have always been there, but what's been added is this layer of social networking and talk shows, which feed on the various views that that Chris was talking about, so that the pent up frustration changes your level of willingness to have the kind of discussion you need to have. The video I mentioned earlier in your program that we use for our effort, it features the leader of the Iowa LGBT community and a minister who is against same-sex marriage, who get together and they meet and discuss their differences and find out that they have a lot in common. And the outcome was, we both feel strongly about our positions and haven't changed that. But what happens as a result of sitting down and realizing that we have a common purpose on this earth is that they, the minister basically said, you know, now when I design the material, I think about Donna and what her response will be. And so that toned down rhetoric hopefully is the end product, and which might lead to better discussion and more civil discourse.
Does that sound right to you, Scott Aiken, from where you're sitting, as far as thinking about where the other person's coming from? You're not changing your mind, but you're changing the rhetoric?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think that Ted's model there sounded exactly right. Finding ways to see the other side as reasonable instead of pathological in these disagreements is really important. And the pathologizing of the other side seems to be a sort of an easy tactic, but it only works with the folks that already agree with you. And by the way, the culture wars seem to be a sort of a place where it's way too easy for people to pathologize the other side.
Huh.
And so, and why? Because it's very easy in culture wars discussions to paint a picture of the kind of person that would disagree with you. And we have words of disparagement on all the sides for the kind of person that would disagree with the other side. And so I think that that's right. I think that having these discussions where people can set good examples for each other and be the kind of person that you can have in mind whenever you're crafting your policy and crafting the reasons for the policy.
Is there any evidence that arguing is good for us or bad for us or anything like that?
So there is So here's some good news and some bad news. The bad news is that if we exchange our reasons with people who we already agree with, what actually happens is that we change our views, but we become more extreme in our views. And this phenomenon is called polarization. And so these group polarization phenomena is that, so for one of the sort of classic cases of this was that they put people who already agreed with each other about abortion issues on both sides, they put each other in two different groups, and they put these folks in two different groups. And what happened was that they changed their minds, but they became more extreme in their views on both sides. And so the way in which you're going to be able to find that you're going to have your views more robustly, and they didn't even seem like they changed their views on the basis of any more reasons. They just changed their views because of the fact that they just were all together and they kind of got into an echo chamber. So it looks like the way that we're going to be able to maintain our views best is being able to argue with each other, and being able to argue with each other not just with the people and give reasons to the people who you already agree with, give reasons to the people who you don't agree with. Mm.
Sometimes you can read comments on online on, you know, whether, you know, comments after an article or something like that. And at a certain point when you're following the string of comments, you think someone's going to bust a blood vessel out there somewhere. They go into all caps. And I just wonder about just our physical health and how it relates to the level of discourse or the incivility of discourse in this country now. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Iris in North Linden, you're on the air. Hi, Iris.
Hi. I'd like to make a comment about the end of the fairness doctrine at the end of the Reagan years. I really and truly believe the fact that it was no longer possible for a well-moderated, competent discussion between people of opposing views on the American broadcast networks, it really did create a big loss in our ability to talk to and learn from each other. It just did turn into a horrible, ugly mess where no one was talking, everyone was screaming. And without the fairness doctrine, I really think it's a huge loss.
That was a broadcasting rule that anyone who had access to the airwaves had to have balance in their broadcasting. Yeah, Chris Jalpe?
I absolutely agree that is an important sort of shift in the law that goes along with important shifts in technology. So the shift from broadcasts to cable news, where you don't have to have the sort of public interest argument to put things on the air, and now going out to the internet and so on, that the changes in the law combined with the changes in the technology by which news is delivered and the expectations that news organizations have that they're going to generate profit from their news organizations, you know, drives the need for viewership. And so I think all of those things kind of bundle together to drive as one of the major drivers of this polarization.
Right, which gets to the issue of what's driving a lot of things, and it's follow the money. Scott Aiken, right?
Oh, absolutely. I think that you might call it the blood sport programming problem. And because Ted had noted this at the very beginning, which is that it's way too often that we've been taking the debate as entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that seems to happen is that a lot of people on the debate stage aren't interested in saying things to each other or even in the cross point or anything like that, or they're more interested in. They look like they're speaking to each other, but they're really speaking to the people who are already listening. They're not speaking to people who are on the stage. They're speaking to the people in the audience and their preferred audience. And so that's one of the reasons why they don't even seem to respond to each other's points. They just escalate some sort of uncivil thing that they'd say to each other.
Iris, thanks a lot for that call. Morgan and Powell, you're on the air. Hi, Morgan.
Hi. One of the guests talked about MSNBC versus Fox to get your information.
Mm-hmm.
And wondering if he has any recommendations. I would like to understand, you know, get other credible sources for both liberal and conservative viewpoints.
So you want some recommendations for good sources that are balanced,
yeah,
or that'll at least
WOSU.
Yeah,
Ann Fisher Show.
NPR.
Well, I already do that.
Besides NPR. And by the way, I mean, I was talking earlier off the air that sometimes I go to those other sides. I want to make sure I'm getting a lot of different sides and points of view. And I start going to the links and I want to see those. What are their sources? What are their primary sources for their assertions? And I do a lot of that. Chris Jalpy?
There was one just to that. This isn't so much what are the strongest sides either on the far left or the far right, but there was one interesting study that evaluated bias in media reporting and found that Reuters News Service is among the most unbiased or among the least biased news sources out there. So check out Reuters.
So, yeah, exactly. And Scott Aiken, recommendations?
So I think that the balanced news sources are great. I also want to get it from as far – and so look at unbalanced places, but I do the balancing. And so I have on my browser – I just pulled it up to just make sure that they're right next to each other. I read the National Review on the right, mm-hmm. and I read the Nation on the left, and I read them back to back.
And checking the primary sources of things when they're citing documents. I want to see what does the Obama administration decision say, and exactly, instead of taking someone's word for it. Morgan, thanks for that. Let's talk now. We only have a few minutes left, but what about Ted Celeste? You were telling me earlier that there's a toolkit.
Right.
For people who want to engage in civil political discourse.
The Institute has created a national campaign called Revive Civility, Our Democracy Depends on It. And as part of that campaign, we've created a website. You go to the Institute's website at nicd.arizona.edu/revivecivility.
We'll put that on our website. Go ahead.
Great. There's a link there that has recommended standards of conduct. That's both for citizens and for media and for elected officials. There's an opportunity to agree and sign on to that code of conduct. Then there's a toolkit for citizens to use in terms of the discussions that we've been having about, well, how do we do this? What kinds of things could we do? We have a program called Text Talk Revive Civility that allows you to, if you just go to 89800 and type in civility, it will lead you through a program. And you'll find that video that I mentioned mm-hmm. earlier, and also the impact of negative advertising. I mean, we haven't touched on that.
But what else does it do? We also know
positive advertising can work. And that's, you know, that's part of what we have to do is reinforce, the citizens have to reinforce that, and that's part of the whole effort. So I'd encourage everybody to take a look at the toolkit, to sign the pledge, and get engaged.
Chris Jalpy.
I think those sound like some excellent tools for people to check out. I would just also note in terms of sort of the political science research on this, there is some research on sort of what causes people to change their mind, what causes people to be able to listen to one another. And that research really points to the importance of empathy in terms of listening to an individual from the other side and validating their view and trying to find a time when you can argue that you felt the same as them. And if you can connect with them about feeling the same way that they feel about an issue, that's what actually opens them up to then listening to you and maybe changing their mind. So there's evidence, for example, that changes people's attitudes about transgender individuals.
Scott Aiken, we have just about 30 seconds left. Last word.
So I think that just maintaining some curiosity about why people have got the views that they've got. You disagree and you can just say, man, I had never thought of taking that view. Can you tell me the reasons why? And doing your best to just hear them.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Scott Aiken, for joining us. I appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
Scott Aiken, he's a professor of philosophy at Vanderbilt University and co-author of a book. It's entitled Why We Argue and How We Should, A Guide to Political Disagreement. And Christopher Jalpy, thanks for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
Christopher Jalpy is a political scientist and chair of peace studies at Ohio State University. And Ted Celeste, thanks to you as well. Appreciate your time.
Thank you, Anne.
Ted Celeste is a former state representative and the director of state programs at the National Institute on Civil Discourse. He'll be moderating a panel discussion on all of these issues next week at the Mershon Center for International Security Studies. We'll have a link to that and the other links that have been mentioned today on our website at wosu.org/allsides. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.